Hello, welcome to Convergent Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I am talking with Ajit Varkey. Ajit has training in many fields and many disciplines, physiology, medicine, biology, biochemistry, from Christian Medical College, University of Nebraska, and Washington University, St. Louis. He's trained and board certified in internal medicine, hematology, and oncology, and has been part of the faculty of the University of California, San Diego since 1982. He's an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, National Academy of Medicine, American Society for Clinical Investigation, Association of American Physicians. He's also the recipient of a Merit Award from the NIH, the American Cancer Society Faculty Research Award, and three highest honors in the field, Carl Meyer Award, International Organizational Award, Rosa Lynn Kornfeld Award for Lifetime Achievement in Glycobiology, and the ASBMB Herbert Tabor Research Award. He was president of the American Society for Clinical Investigation. He was president of the Society for Glycobiology and was editor-in-chief of the Journal of Clinical Investigation. He has done so many wonderful things within his fields of study, and he has also written a fascinating book with the late Danny Brower. That book is called Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind, which is what we talk about in this conversation. Now, I think I mentioned it in the conversation, but I read this book probably 10 years ago. It's been out for about 15, I believe. And I just found it absolutely fascinating. How did we evolve to deceive ourselves, deception, lying, false beliefs? I found that very, very interesting. And Ajit and Danny, they met once, I think, in person for an hour and a half, 2 hours. And then Danny tragically, died quite suddenly at a pretty young age. And he kind of takes over his idea and his theory and made it into a book and expanded on it. And that's what the book Denial is about, covers the theory. So we talk all about it. We talk about the evolutionary perspective of human origins, self-awareness in humans, theory of mind, false beliefs in denial and how they evolved. We discuss lying, self-deception, religion, positive uses of deception, climate change, the future of the mind over reality theory, which is presented in the book, and many other topics. I have been wanting to talk to him for a while, and it was wonderful rereading the book, and it was wonderful to talk with him. As is mentioned in the beginning of the conversation, unfortunately, Ajit has developed Parkinson's disease, which he was kind enough to give his time and his energy. Even though his body is struggling in some ways, his mind is very sharp. He still has so much to offer and contribute from what he already has in his career. And I really, took it very well that he gave me his time, despite all the challenges that he's facing to talk about his work. So it was really a big honor to have him come on and discuss it. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergentdialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube. Get over there, follow, like, subscribe, share widely with your friends. If you like this conversation, take a look around at all the other ones. There's bound to be other conversations I've had with other people that are similar topics. Definitely have talked about evolution a ton on the podcast, so give those a listen as well. And support Ajit's work. And now I bring him, Ajit Varkey. I am here with Ajit Varkey. Ajit, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm greatly honored to have you on here.
My pleasure.
So we're going to talk all about a book that you wrote, and you had a co-author, posthumously, he's been deceased for many years. The book is called Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. And you go through much territory in the book. It's been out for a couple of years, but you've continued on with this. And it's very, very fascinating. So I really want to get into it. I should say at the outset for listeners, that Ajit has been so kind enough to give us time and energy. He has been dealing with early onset Parkinson's, so you may hear some of the difference in vocal intonations and kind of maybe prosody of speech and things like that. So he's allowed me to let listeners know that at the top. And even bigger thanks for being able to do the conversation and amidst all of those challenges. So I greatly appreciate that. Okay, so
it's ironic that we're going to talk about humans and Parkinson's disease may be a human specific disease. So it's poetic justice.
So yeah, there it is. Right, it's very ironic. So just really quick before we get into the book, just tell listeners a brief snapshot of who you are professionally, academically, and what you currently still do.
Yeah, I'm currently a distinguished professor of medicine and cell and molecular medicine, University of California, San Diego. I was born in India and had my early training in India. I went to Christian Medical College, Vellore, which is one of the prominent medical schools in India. Mm. Came to the U.S. In 1975. And stayed on eventually to become a physician scientist and worked on hematology and oncology mostly. But then I ran into some interesting things that directed me towards human evolution. Ended up writing this book, which I didn't intend to write originally. So,
And you continued to still teach and do research at the university?
I've come back on my research with these health problems, and also I could do a little bit of research and do some teaching, but not as much anymore.
Very nice.
I'm still keeping in touch. I started an organization called CARTA, which is about the origin of human origins, origin of humans, and that's now been taken over by others. If you look that up, anybody can look it up, CARTA, and you'll find about 500 talks about human origins of different angles.
Mm, wonderful. Yeah, well, it's your contributions are fantastic. So maybe you just tell us how the book came about. You talk about it in the introduction of the book, but just give me the brief, overview story of how this book came about, how you met Danny, how you continued on with the book. Just give us that brief story there.
So as I mentioned, as hematologist, oncologist, I treat people with cancer. And I noticed that people with cancer and the doctors are very optimistic about what might happen, even though things weren't that optimistic. And then I had, my daughter was born, and I wondered how this helpless baby became a human being over time. And I also happened to find the first genetic difference between humans and chimpanzees. Came from an observation, hematology, actually. So back in the 80s, it was thought that there was only humans and chimps had identical genes and they expressed differently. Now we know it's very different. But at that time, they were unknown. And I found the first known genetic difference in humans and chimpanzees. So occasionally I give a talk about this, and occasionally I talk about what makes us human, a little bit outside my field at that time, especially. Sat down for lunch at the University of Arizona, gave a lecture, sat down for lunch, and this fellow sat next to me and said, "You're all asking the wrong question." So I thought he's some kind of kook, and I listened to him further, realized he had a really interesting idea I'd never thought about before. So I said, his name was Danny Brower. I said, "Danny, you should talk." And we sat there for an hour and a half after everybody had left lunch. I came back, couldn't get his idea out of my mind. So I finally tried to find him, and a year later, I looked up and I found his obituary. He had dropped dead very suddenly. Mm. So I contacted his friends, and some people said, yeah, he was writing a book. I didn't know what happened exactly, but he never published anything about his idea. So I wrote a letter to Nature describing Danny's idea and my embellishments of it. Mm. And I thought that was the end of it. Then his widow contacted me and said, "Can you please finish Danny's book?" Mm. So I ended up writing a book with a dead man who I'd met for an hour and a half. It gave me a great idea. And so he's a cause, of course, but of course it's developed a lot beyond what he originally thought, but the original idea came from him. Mm. And so now that's what I'm going to be talking about today. And the book came out after that based on the discussion and my subsequent investigations.
Mm. Yeah, it's so interesting how these things can happen sometimes where you have a chance meeting with somebody, they tell you a cool idea. And then, you can kind of get with it. And then sometimes life is wild and how it will take people from us. And we're left with these ideas. And what do we do with it? So I think it's great that A, that you continued with it, and B, that you, gave him the co-authorship as well, not just like an acknowledgement or something.
And it's better got 30%, 50% of the proceeds.
Yeah, no, that's great. Huge. Yeah. So you cover a lot of ground in the book. The main thing I want to talk about, and we'll get into this, is theory of mind, self-awareness, mind over reality, all that stuff. But I want to ask just generally, if you set it up for us, obviously, you know, there's a whole thing of this that you can go into. Mm-hmm. But I guess just kind of sort of for the purposes of what you're trying to explain in the book and what you've gone on to explain after, this idea of understanding us as humans and how we are from an evolutionary perspective. Because what you talk about early in the book is not how did we evolve the way that we did, but why other animals didn't evolve the way that we did or other things. And so maybe just tell us that there's this like 5 million year history of the apes, which have, you know, all the progenitors for, you know, you have Australopithecus and Homo erectus, and you get to Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. So this is big, big, big history. Why is it important contextually to understand this evolutionary lineage and this framework for some of the ideas about self-awareness and personhood?
Yeah, so many people have worked on the origin of humans, and the general idea has always been that somehow a particular group of apes evolved into a lineage which has then evolved all these new cognitive mechanisms and became us. And Danny Brower said you're asking the wrong question, because if you look through nature, you find crows, chimpanzees, dolphins, whales, many, many smart creatures all over the world. They've been around for 500 million years. Mm-hmm. Very smart, very social, very warm-blooded, very capable of doing all kinds of interesting things that we thought they couldn't do. But there's only one human. Mm-hmm. So you should be asking, she said, you shouldn't be asking what made us human. You should ask what stopped everybody else. So he called it the wall. And expanded to call it the evolution psychological barrier. In other words, there were many species around, Neanderthals, dinosaurs, many other species closely related to us. Yet there's only one of us left standing, and we've taken over the world, basically, and destroying it now. Mm. And the question is, why is there only one of us? Mm. That's the question. So you look at the last 500 million years, and there were many lineages, actually, especially in the last few hundred thousand years across the old world. Mm-hmm. But there's only one of us left. And since I did the book, I've come to the conclusion that maybe the thing I'm talking about is the barrier that resulted in only one species being present with these abilities.
One of the things that makes humans, or the things that make us somewhat unique of sorts, or different, if you will, and many people have written about this, is we have bigger brains that show increased intelligence, cognition, abstraction, etc. We can make tools, we can problem solve, we're bipedal, we have niche selection. All of these things are relevant to humans, and it's not that other animals don't have them. I mean, there's a certain type of intelligence for, you know, crows and other animals. But all of these things, we also have this ability for language and high abstraction and all of these elements that we understand through genetics and social environmental changes. How are all of these things putting us on the road for self-awareness, theory of mind, which we'll come to in a minute, but how do these things are basically the building blocks or the parts needed to have those things, and why other animals maybe don't?
Mm-hmm. Just a quick statement. Big brains are overrated. And those big brains are important for humans in our evolution. There's plenty of evidence we'll talk about another time, but big brains are not required at the present time. So you talk about bird brains, right? I just told you crows and dolphins. I think you had Nicola Caton on your
I did.
Program.
Yeah, she was lovely.
You've heard about
the
amazing things that birds can do, right?
Yeah, that's great research.
So that's the big brain in humans is an interesting problem, which we don't understand. It needs to be studied later, but it's not necessary. It's necessary, but not sufficient. So going back to these things, yeah, something happened that allowed us to break through into these additional features that mostly social mammals and birds don't have. And you talk about language, high abstraction, all these things. You can make a long list of things that are uniquely human or unusually human. Actually, the word uniquely is dangerous to give in any such context. You say, I tend to call it, my friend Pascal Gagnon and I tend to call it distinctly human. Something that are not found in close relatives. You might find in some other lineage somewhere else. But so we have these very, very unusual abilities. And language, as you said, is very important. Our social, environmental interactions, high abstraction, ability to think of the future and the past and so on. And as you're going to talk about thinking of the minds of others. Mm. So really coming back to Danny's question, says, how come only we did it? So that's the question.
Mm. And so what do you think, I guess, you know, after writing the book and all these things, what do you feel is the answer for that, of why we can do it and other animals cannot?
So I think the reason is, I think that this, what Danny called the wall originally, mm-hmm. which I call now the psychological evolutionary barrier, is what we got across and everybody has got stuck at. So think of a physiological evolutionary barrier. If you're trying to go from water to land, it took about millions of years for that to be achieved, because going from water to land is not easy, right? You don't just cross over and just start walking on the land. Mm-hmm. Many, many, many trials had to occur, and through evolutionary selection, eventually a few species managed to make it onto land.
Right.
So that's a physiological evolutionary barrier. So I'm talking about a psychological evolutionary barrier, something that stops all the other animals in their tracks. Basically, they can't evolve any further along this lineage. And we kind of broke through a wormhole, I think, and came out with this ability, basically. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. And so connected with this is we have self-awareness. Now, we're not the only ones that have self-awareness. Right. Maybe tell me about, you talk about in the book, obviously there's been papers about it. Obviously people for a long time really emphasized, okay, to know yourself or to see or recognize yourself is, you know, there's an element of abstraction, right? To know that it's mm-hmm. not something else or whatever. And many animals cannot do this. But we have this measure, this mirror self-recognition task, right? That, you know, can an animal look mm-hmm. at themselves in the mirror and they recognize it's them, it's not someone else, or they just see nothing. And so we know a few animals that have done this. But then afterwards, people got really excited about this. But then people started saying, well, that's not really saying anything, though. It's not really saying what we want it to say. Yeah, yeah. It's not telling what we want it to really say, what we're trying to, this idea of knowing yourself or knowing your personhood. So maybe just tell us about generally self-awareness and how much you do or don't like the mirror self-recognition task.
Yeah, now. I think, to be very clear, I'm not an expert in most of these topics. I'm sort of self-taught expert, but mm-hmm. there's certainly problems with this, with the mirror self-recognition test, where you put a spot on a sleeping animal's head and then they get used to a mirror, and then the dog or the monkey will just look at it for a while and then think it's another animal and leave. The chimpanzee will go look behind the mirror to see who's in, who's there. Mm-hmm. And come back and look at himself, herself, and say, oh, that's me. Start examining herself. So what you have to say is, what's also notable is the absence of self-recognition in so many creatures. That's what I think is significant. Mm-hmm. And so happens that the creatures that have self-recognition are exactly the same ones I talked about. Dolphins, elephants, mm-hmm. chimpanzees, mm-hmm. crows, all these species recognize mm-hmm. themselves in the mirror. Mm-hmm. So there's something going on there, which is equivalent to saying, you know, if that's me, I'm actually a person, you know, and I can recognize myself. Mm. Mm. It's hard to prove conclusively, and I'm sure every species has some level of recognition of the environment and themselves, but these particular species, again, by coincidence, happen to the same ones of self-awareness.
Mm. Mm. So do we think that, you know, again, I mean, you know, is this a thing that we should continue to use to make sense of this, or maybe the mirror self-recognition isn't as important as we think it is?
I think it's no longer that important, because it's a step along the way to where we are now. Mm. Mm. So we are not only self-aware, we are aware of the self-awareness of others. I'm aware of your self-awareness. That's why we're able to have this conversation, right? Mm. Mm. I realize that others have minds like mine. Mm. So the awareness of self-awareness, mm. of the other self-awareness of others. Mm. So, that's the next step.
Yeah, yeah. So in the book, you talk about theory of mind, which many people have you know, talked about this and written about this, and we don't have to get into it here. But you know, many folks within that research and do a lot of study on autism spectrum disorders talk a lot about theory of mind, etc. So maybe just tell us. You give these four stages, which are really, really interesting. I liked how you organized it. This self-awareness, right. The rudimentary theory of mind, full theory of mind, and extended theory of mind. So maybe just, yeah, right. Tell us what it is and how you break it down in these four categories.
So basically, the theory of mind is many terms: intentionality, attribution of mental states, intersubjectivity, mind reading, perspective taking, other recording impulses, many terms of use. Basically, it's a recognition that somebody else has a mind like yours or is different from yours, and you can recognize that person as another individual of the mind. Mm-hmm. And so the term I chose to use is theory of mind. It's not the only one. But I found that it's hard to define it exactly because it goes to different levels. I came arbitrarily, you know, some of the experts may not like it, I came up with four stages. Early self-awareness, like you have in a new, in a two-year-old child who can recognize himself in the mirror. Mm-hmm. Rudimentary theory of mind, like a 4 or 5 year old that can recognize the minds of parents, and but by the age of 6 or so, they start telling lies and they get really good at it. And by the time they're 15, they can talk to people all across the internet, recognize the minds of everybody across the planet. And that's extended to you. So it's not a continuum. It's just it's a continuum, not steps actually. I just use it as a practical way of approaching it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think everybody else stops. All the other species I mentioned stop at the level of blended theory of mind. Mm-hmm. And full theory of mind, but they don't have the extended theory of mind, I think.
Mm-hmm. So the things about the extended theory of mind is some of the things that make us, what did you say, distinct, right, as humans?
Distinct, yeah.
And I'm going to go with that a little bit, another step further. When we think of theory of mind, for example, briefly when I talked about this, there's usually this example of like, I can read a novel, let's say Sherlock Holmes, right?
Exactly.
And I can read the story, and I'm reading the story, and in the story, the character, let's say Sherlock Holmes, is thinking about what Watson is thinking about and what he dreamed about and all these things. There's a certain layers of abstraction there because my mind is reading a book that was written by someone long ago, and this came from their mind, out of a created character's mind, thinking about another created character's mind. There's just a full level of abstraction here that, as far as we know, other animals probably can't do.
Yeah. Because obviously language helps there, but
sure,
being able to, I often use the Sherlock Holmes example just to say that if I say Mahatma Gandhi, you know who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. If I talk about Sherlock Holmes, who never even existed, you still know what I'm talking about. If you've read about him, seen a movie or something like that. So,
Right.
So that's the ability humans have of imagining the minds of others and imagining the minds of others that don't even exist. So.
Yeah.
It's very powerful, right? I mean, it should be a really powerful thing in evolution to get this.
Right. So you've talked about the wall already. So I guess the big middle part, the real central thing of the book, is this idea that we've evolved false beliefs about a situation, namely that we can deny reality of something. And that we do this, and maybe other animals do not, or who's to say, but how, talk about this. How do we develop these false beliefs where we can deny the reality of something? We don't usually think of it that way.
Right. If you think about reality, and maybe humans are quite at least one species capable of really understanding reality. We can think and imagine the Big Bang even, and atoms and things like that. Mm-hmm. We understand reality. Yet we can routinely deny reality, as you can see all around us all the time, right? Even right now. In every situation, you see humans do that. That's actually a very bad thing, right? If you start out as an animal that has a little bit of ability to be a little brave would be useful, but at some point you're going to get in trouble. If you're a wild beast that wants to go and check out the lions, you're not going to last very long, right? Mm-hmm. So any species that achieves the ability to corrupt reality, alter reality, or ignore reality or modify it in any way they want, shouldn't be around, basically. So that's an evolutionary negative, basically. Mm. So that's the idea that this was come from, but it's not very useful. But there's one reality that's very scary, and that is death. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So every animal has a unique built-in fight or flight response and a fear of death all the time. They don't know what it is, but they have an intrinsic fear. Mm. So how come I don't get up every morning and say, "Ooh, I might die today"? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even my patients with cancer would say, "Oh, I'm going to make it." You know, mm-hmm. Where do you get that? Mm. And so that's the unusual feature of, I've coined the term reality denial. It's slightly different from what's out there. I don't want to call it just denial. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to ignore or modify or adjust or corrupt reality in different ways to the point where we eventually believe it completely ourselves. So look at some of the conspiracy theories out there these days. You know,
how I guess, I think people, I mean, before I read the book, I never really thought about it. And when I reread it before our conversation, and it still hit me again of, I feel like a lot of the times we take this for granted, right? This ability, because you're right. I mean, if I'm walking, or if I wake up every morning and I think, when am I going to die? Is it going to be the next mm-hmm. moment? Am I going to have this? Is this going to happen? Am I going to get hit by something? And we wouldn't be able to survive there. So I guess the question here is how essential is this component to suspend our belief in existence for a minute, or to deny that we're going to die for a minute, or keep it at bay? How important is that for us to survive now, but maybe in times past? What do you think about this?
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, there's modern versions of this. There's the denial of death, Ernst Becker book, and then later came the terror management theory, where they talked about this. They point out that if you point out humans that the danger of mortality, they do get concerned about it, but don't get very concerned about it. So the question is why? Mm. So we should be scared to death about it, because the more we understand, the more dangerous things look like. So we're not. So how do we do this? And that's where this barrier comes in. So the idea is that this reality denial, or corruption reality, whatever you want to call it, may be occurring in some animals occasionally, but then it's actually a bad thing. You're going to be done in, basically, because you're not going to follow the reality. And if you have that situation, then that's a dead end. Mm. The idea here is that, as Danny started out with and I expanded on, is that the other thing that's not positive is realizing you're going to die. Mm. And so how do you realize you're going to die? You watch somebody else die. So many sophisticated animals see others die and they may react to it. But if you have full theory of mind, you understand the mind of the others as a person, then what does that translate into? I'm next. Mm-hmm. So imagine you're an elephant that gets theory of mind. You're the first person to evolve in the last 100,000 years. It's great, right? You can tell lies. We just said it's very, very powerful. You can do many things, but you can control everything. Mm. Then his friend dies in battle, who he knew as another person. Says, "Oh, I'm next. Mm-hmm. What's he going to do? He's going to hide in the woods, right? Mm-hmm. He's not going to fight. He's not going to pass on his genes." Mm. Or a woman watches her sister die in childbirth and says, mm-hmm. "Ooh,
I'm not going to do that. Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
Not going to do that. Right, at the end of reproduction." So the idea here is that this had developed as the book came along and more recently, is that two evolution negatives, both of which are very bad initially and occur very rarely, have to come together in the same brains at the same time. So two rare negatives come together and generate an unusual state like ours, and you slip through that wormhole, you get past that barrier or the wall, now you've got humans. Mm. But that can also help to explain why there's only one of us, basically. Mm. We came out of Africa. We were in Africa probably 200,000-300,000 years ago. About 50,000-100,000 years ago, came out of Africa, spread across the world, and basically took over everything and made it with all the other species that are very much like us. But I imagine that they hadn't passed this barrier yet, and they couldn't pick up all the right genes from this new group. And so those who had it basically succeeded in the competition eventually. It's not like, humans didn't arrive in Europe and wipe out the Neanderthals all of a sudden. It took 20,000 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. But over the long haul, all the other human-like species failed, basically, and we survived. And this theory can, I started saying this in the book, and I think of it more, this might be true, that this maybe explain this peculiarity of a single species that replaced everybody else.
I'm listening to you talk about this, and it's just so interesting to think and sit with it. I think about, I'm sure you and listeners and myself included have been to a funeral, right? Mm-hmm. And, it's a tough moment. No one likes funerals. People don't like funerals because maybe it's sad because they lost a loved one. Mm-hmm. But I always think about this because I've unfortunately been to many funerals. I always think about myself in the box, right? I think about what happens when I'm there? What happens when everybody's here for me? and I'm no longer in existence. And like, it's just so, I don't want to think about it, right? It's just terrible. Right, I don't want to think about it, but it will happen. And I think that's maybe sometimes why people don't like funerals, but I think it's also this idea of it's like if we're spending a lot of time avoiding the reality of death, right? As we probably need to, the idea of the funeral
it's now built into us, basically.
Right.
To varying extents. You have people all the way from the evil Knievel to the anxious person who can't leave home in the morning. So you've got the full range. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the idea of funerals or death in that way is just kind of forcing us to like behold it. We have to see.
But on the other hand, it quotes some old Hindu scriptures about vairagyams, different sort of resolutions. Mm. So you're in the funeral, say, I'm going to be a better person. I'm going to improve myself. I'm going to be a good person when I die. People will think greatly of me.
Fair, yeah.
Two hours later, you're asking your wife, what's for dinner?
Yeah, that's true.
And if it wasn't somebody very close, it's gone. The feeling's gone, right? So the TNT people often show that you expose people to death, for a short time after they change the way they behave and their reactions, so on. Mm. Eventually, it just fades out, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's another example of these abilities we have. In a way, it's suppressing that belief.
Yeah, most certainly. There's one bit I picked up this time reading it with the book when I didn't get it the first time, which was there was something you said in there. I'm curious what you mean. You said that reality denial is in place before the emergence of full theory of mind. Why is that ordering of things important, you think?
Sort of a chicken and egg problem. Mm. We just said that reality denial is bad news, right, by itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We'd be arguing that extended theory of mind by itself would be bad news because you would have what I call now mortality salience, understanding of immortality, and the fear any animal should have of that knowledge should shut you down, basically.
Mm.
So I don't think I thought about it, I think what happened is that we talk about briefly in the book that you had to co-evolve both things together. And that's the thing that made it very difficult. You have to have the same individuals develop the same abilities at the same time.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, that's why it's very rare.
Mm. That's very interesting. I can see the kind of chicken egg problem here. Is this like, you know, okay, which one is there?
They probably co-evolve, basically. It's both cultural and genetic, and you have to have the right condition. You know, Sarah Hurdy likes to point out that the newborn human baby would never survive with just her mom. If it wasn't for all the other aunties and grandmothers around to help out, and they all couldn't read each other's minds a little bit, it wouldn't work.
Mm.
You certainly have other species that have cooperative breeding. Nowadays, humans are unusual in that lineage, but we have the ability. She suggests that's maybe the early stage of the development theory of mind.
Mm. So when we think about this, I want to ask about one other concept you have here, which you talk about is this idea of lying. And you mentioned it earlier already, that full theory of mind, even extended theory of mind, allows one to be more effective at lying about things, which you can see. There's self-deception. There's deception generally, deception with other people. And maybe there's some advantage in selecting mates there, but most people think of lying as a negative thing, which I think it can be a lot of the times, but maybe not always. But what do you think about this notion of self-deception and lying, whether to ourselves or to other people? Is there any positive valence on that in terms of our evolution, or how do you see it?
Just look at the success of many politicians right now.
Eventually,
you come to the point where if you lie about something long enough, everybody believes it, basically. That's what
you
did originally.
Yeah.
And so it's basically something that can be both extreme positive, extreme negative. You can be like Mahatma Gandhi and take advantage of that knowledge. Or you can just take over others by lying and modifying and changing reality for others and for yourself. And like you said, there's a lot of good books written about self-deceptions.
Mm-hmm.
We also corrupt our own reality, right? So as I think, who put it, we are in denial of the denial of our own denial.
Well, again, it's a layers deep of abstraction, even on the deception point, right? Or is it we're doing all these different things, which is incredible how we're able to do that. But I wonder on this bit of it, right? So we have these ideas, we have this way of trying to deny reality, we have self-deception. And we do this with other people as well, obviously for nefarious purposes sometimes or many times. Mm-hmm. I want to ask about something I thought about from the book. First time I read it and the second time is this. You can get as spicy as you want here, but do you think there's an evolutionary model for why religions came into existence as a way of deceiving ourselves or as a way to give us a system to get the answer so we don't think about dying? We know where we go when we die, or we know which way we have to live while we're here. Is that too reductionistic?
It's an interesting question. Yeah, I was raised in Judeo-Christian. I'm a Syrian Christian from South India originally. So I learned all about the Bible. I got scripture prize and whatnot. But I'm an agnostic right now.
I was very similar there. I also was raised fundamentalist Christian.
The other religion taught me how to behave well and not lie and be good to people and so on.
Right.
So we all live like Jesus, we'd be in much better condition, you know, be like Jesus. So. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, religion could have helped along the way here, denying reality, and could have helped us deny death at a mass scale. But then there are religions like Judaism, where I understand that there's not that much attention to afterlife.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for what you live at this time. So you don't necessarily need that. An atheist would get up every morning and say, oh, I'm going to die today. You know, so it could have helped along the way. I think religions probably co-evolved along with this theory of mind. Here's the thing, if you take a list of a huge number of lists of things, language, religion, you know, art, all kinds of things, put them all together and take away denial, or take away theory of mind. Mm-hmm. You'd have maybe a child on autism spectrum, which they have more limited theory of mind. There's one theory about that. And they can do many things, but they're somewhat more limited in some aspects. Mm-hmm. Same thing would happen with anyone that's got any other problems with that. But religion is one way of dealing with these issues at a mass scale. And it certainly helped a lot of humans, some groups of humans survive and do well, but it's also given other humans a reason to be really destructive. Mm. I think most of what we're talking about here is men, not women. Mm-hmm.
Is it incomplete, or, you know, there's many people that have said things about religion as a kind of cultural evolution, a kind of way in which people have evolved this. You know, a lot of research shows that, you know, religion doesn't necessarily offer, I mean, it does, but it's not the morals that keep people together. It's more of the built sense of community building, right? That's a major variable there. Do you think that... people need to survive in groups or cohabitate together in ways where they don't kill each other, they don't harm each other.
Yeah.
That religion is a kind of adhesive that keeps people together,
big groups through time. Certainly see that. You see what's happening right now as religions are getting into trouble more and more. We're also losing the good part of religion also at the same time. So that's the case. There's a book by Robert McCall, it's not very often quoted, but Why Religion is Natural and Science is Not. So people like you and me say, science, that's the answer, right? You got the facts. But imagine if you went out to a hunter-gatherer who has no education and say, you're made of atoms and you came from a Big Bang 13 billion years ago. So I said, what the hell are you talking about? And then you see lightning strike there and say, what's that? So, oh, that's God. He killed my brother, you know. So the idea Macaulay puts forward is that religion is more natural to humans to come up with idea explanation of what the natural, as you get more and more reality salience, you have to deal with it. And religion is a natural way to do that. Mm-hmm. And science is, of course, the more modern way to do it. It started in the Far East and worked its way to Europe and eventually with what we now call the Age of Enlightenment. It's a very short time. It may not be last very long.
Well, and it does also just kind of remind me of that, again, I mean, to try to be respectful for people's beliefs. So here, but is this idea that narratives still to this day are such powerful ways of connecting people. That's why we read books and we see films and we watch TV shows and all these. It's a narrative that pulls things together, not kind of the hard scientific facts. And okay, that's going to tell me you need it woven together in a narrative. And religion is very powerful at doing that. It's very powerful at telling good narratives to help us together, you know? But yes, there are, we can believe our beliefs too hard sometimes and gets us into trouble. So I think there's a danger there. I guess a little bit here is on, you've mentioned a little bit, and this is probably where that extended theory of mind comes in, the role of cultural and technological advances throughout time have helped us to deny this reality at kind of a fast pace. How essential is that as we see cultural and technological and a digital revolutions throughout time? How do these things also help us, you know, kind of hold off the bad parts of reality we don't like?
Yeah, well, positive, I mean, denial of reality is really very powerful in many ways. I mean, what is optimism? Denial of reality. Mm-hmm. What is extreme optimism? Extreme denial of reality, right? Mm. My grandfather is a friend of Gandhi, and I grew up thinking, what is this man thinking? He's going to take on the British Empire with nonviolence? You know, what the hell is that? Mm-hmm. And when he succeeds, but he pays the price, but then you get Nelson Mandela, and then you get Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The theory of mind being spread from there, right? So, what Charlie Sherratt calls the optimism bias, humans are intrinsically optimistic, basically. Mm. If you weren't optimistic, we wouldn't get out of bed every day. And the few humans who are not optimistic at all, usually those who are depressed, basically, because they appreciate reality. Sometimes it's called depressive realism.
Yeah. But isn't there this idea that, I think it's from social psych, that we tend to have a kind of a trait negativity bias, right? That we usually are going to think, okay, what's the worst that's going to happen, right? Let me make sure I don't get harmed. Let me make sure I don't get killed. But do we also have this, it sounds like we have a mixture of both, that we can not stay there, but that we do have a propensity as well to also say, how can I look at the positive aspects of things as well? And then you can transmit that through other big thinkers and movements.
Right. Yeah, so here's the problem. So the same brain to hold optimism and pessimism and reality at the same time is very hard. So you've got to be in one place or the other. Mm. So it's very difficult because you have to be in the middle, either you're one extreme or the other. Mm-hmm. So look at climate change and climate disaster going on right now.
Yeah,
many of us understand and appreciate it, but we somehow think somehow it's going to work out. Somehow it's going to work out. I don't know how it's going to work out. Humans will figure it out, you know. We don't do everything we should be doing. On the other hand, if you didn't have the optimism, you just curl up and give up. You know, nothing would ever happen. So you have these two powerful ends of the spectrum of optimism and total reality understanding, and everything in between, and the human population. And I think that gives power to do many things that any other animals couldn't. So basically,
I guess the thing was, so you mentioned climate change in the book, and obviously it's mm-hmm. unfortunately always an evergreen kind of topic for all the wrong reasons. But I find this is also difficult too, right? Because like it's a kind of species type of extinction thing. Mm-hmm. And it's tough. It's bleak, obviously, right? But I guess it's also one of those things where when we have positive moments where think about things like, yes, we can acknowledge human involvement for the mm-hmm. changing of the planet. And obviously it's climate change is real and humans are a big factor in that.
So they call it climate corruption.
Yeah. Yes. But we do have some positive moments too, where people, you know, we're trying our best to, you know, solar panels, electric cars, reforestation, trying to fix some aspects of the coral reef. We do have positive moments. I feel like it's such a hard thing when you hear something that's factually based, that is real, and then it says, well, we don't want to look at the positive things because then it might make us forget that there's really a big problem still out there. How do we do both of these things at the same time?
Yeah, it's just difficult to have the same brains do the same thing. So a friend of mine, V. Ramanathan at Scripps here, he's the one who convinced one of the people who convinced the Pope to put out his encyclical on climate change. Convinced him. So I've talked to Ram over the years, what do you do about this? I said, you know, he said, you have to be optimistic. You have to tell people that it's going to be okay. You've got to work hard at it. Mm-hmm. They don't. It doesn't work then. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the other extreme is fear, right? Mm-hmm. Fear is very powerful, but it can be a bad motivator in other ways.
Sure, yeah.
So if you think of all the things, except one exception I can think of is the threat of nuclear destruction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mass destruction. That's the only thing where maybe the ozone layer, where we humans said, you know, this is really bad. We should not have this happen.
Right.
We actually got together and did something about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
But in most cases, we just ignore the reality as much as we can.
Mm.
We do it ourselves, you know. So mm-hmm. my daughter called me up and said, I'm coming to Miami. Should I drop over to San Diego? I said, sure, please do so immediately. And it's just burned a bunch of fossil fuel, right?
Yeah. It's so interesting because, you know, we live in the age of Oppenheimer, right? And it's one of these things where, you know, there's this notion of it's awful that we see this. We all say we don't want the next Hiroshima Nagasaki, but would we say that if that didn't happen? Now, I in no means think it should have happened. Absolutely. I wish it didn't. Right. But it's terrible that we have to have or that we are that way, or it's like, oh, wow, that is really bad. But why do we need human tragedy at such a mass scale to say, maybe we don't do that anymore? That's terrible.
Yeah, it's because I think, you know, the fear factor comes in there. And you begin to realize, you know, when I was growing up in India, I remember hearing about children in the Cold War, U.S. duck and cover, you know. So there's this scare children every day about nuclear war because of the possibility. That generation grew up saying, we can't let this happen, you know. As you said, it's already been one example. But the climate change is a bit difficult because it's harder for people to appreciate what's going on. I think it's find that right medium between fear and realism and optimism and active approach. So it's come up with a kind of way to summarize. Is there a way to be hope for the best but prepare for the worst? Can the same brain do that?
I mean,
often not the case.
I think in some ways we can, but it's hard to know. It's not always really enough. So there are positive aspects of denying reality. I mean, I think that you know, day to day, but even when people have chronic illness or terminal illness or or things like that, you can't just sit with that. You have to say, okay. You know, but that seems so counterintuitive in some ways, right? Logically, from our logical brains to say, well, I'm going to actively deny reality. And I wonder how much of our lives, when you realize things, when you think about free will, let's say, you know, this kind of, for me, this illusionary aspect of free will, and that we have this idea of denying reality and self-deception. I mean, when people ask what's true and what's real, we don't ever really operate that way most times. It's such a paradox, no? I mean, what do you think about these positive aspects in this component?
Yeah, look at preventive medicine. They're tearing the hair out. They told us exactly how we can live longer and be healthier, right? Everybody says yes. I'm a physician. I don't know most of the things I'm supposed to do. I do my exercise this morning and do the things I'm supposed to do for my health. I said, it won't happen to me, you know, but somebody else. And so there's this ability to, even for people who have the full knowledge, still carry the denial in their heads. But without that, they can't live, basically. So both theory of mind and denial can be used for extreme, both very positive, very negative reasons. So,
yeah. That's such a strange way to say it that way. I mean, I totally agree with you. But in order to live, we have to have a way of deceiving ourselves of the realities that are there. And that's such a wild paradox, right? Like, it's when you say it out loud, it's crazy.
Well, the thing is, you have to think about it in evolutionary terms. People always say, I'm not so scared about it. It'll be okay. You know? So you should think back to the first individuals in Africa who came up with this concept of theory of mind and fear of death. And then they're in really serious trouble till they can start denying reality or cause some circular argument there. That's very hard to bring together, basically.
Yeah. So I guess one of the last questions I have for you is, you know, where do you think as we progress as a human species, you know, we have all of this integration with, you know, different forms of technology and connected digitally and all these things. How do we, this, you know, theory here, this is, you know, mind over reality kind of thing. How do we see this progressing, I guess, in the future? What do you think is the ways in which we continue to wrestle with these things and maybe from a bigger view, kind of the long, long view in terms of evolution or things like that? How do we see, what do you think would be iterations of this when you look to the future?
Unfortunately, I think we're in real trouble because most of us, including myself, find some level of denial about something or the other that we should be paying attention to, the natural state of humans. And now as we move into virtual reality and other states, altered states, and even our children spend half their awake time sometimes just being in a different world. You know, our brains have evolved 200,000 years ago, not evolved to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to get more and more trouble as people alter reality and constantly in all directions. So I'm a little bit pessimistic about the whole thing, I'm afraid. But
Yeah, well, there's certainly major concerns. I guess the one thing here is, you know, is such a fascinating idea. Such a fascinating. The book's great. I guess what are you know, a few things or any big things that you want to share with listeners about your ideas on this, or any way you want people to think about this? What are some of your kind of final thoughts here on any of this?
So just to explain why the book came out so long ago and did not much talk about it. I met Danny Broad at the time and I was very busy with other things and wrote the book. And here's a book by an insect geneticist, dead insect geneticist, Danny, a physician scientist who claimed to have understood the human mind, right? So we had the right people to come up with an idea like this. So it hasn't really taken root. And I haven't taken the trouble to pursue it further and really push it out.
Mm-hmm.
As I should have, because I have many other things that I do and succeed in better. And there's some websites like Rob Milkowski, I think his name, undenial.com. There's several people who I get the emails every month or so saying, "Oh, I read your book. Finally, I understand what's wrong with people." You know, so so think about this book is to say that the theory is to say this theory is not proven.
Right.
It's consistent with all known facts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, Thomas Huxley, the famous compatriot of Charles Darwin, said, "A beautiful theory is slain by an ugly fact."
Mm-hmm.
So I've been searching for the last 20 years for an ugly fact that slays this theory.
Mm-hmm.
If you can find one, any married listener can find one, let me know. Not something that I don't like, that doesn't help me. because of this fact, it cannot be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It fits everything, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you look around. So.
It's
consistent with everything.
I mean, you need good theory, right? You need good theory to build off of things and you test, you prove it, but you can't do the reverse, right? Just testing and proving something without theory is, I don't think, always the best. I think good theory can go far, and you're right. It's rooted in all of the things, genetics, evolutionary biology, things like that. And so,
especially things that happen very rarely, you know, so
mm-hmm,
humans
mm-hmm.
emerge only once.
Yeah.
Actually, I've come back to think about this more. If you come to the emergency room in coma and you don't have any relatives with you, mm-hmm. there's a few things in your pocket, the worst thing you can do is call your neurologist immediately. Mm-hmm. And you want a general physician who looks over the whole body and looks at what's going on and then figures out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you call the neurologist in. I think we've got to be careful to assume that logic, there's no, as you know, there's no intelligent designer.
Mm-hmm.
So this happened only once.
Yeah.
It's like that single patient in a coma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to happen anyway. So it could have been the most bizarre way you think of. So logic won't give you the answer. But what we see now is the end product. We just can't go back and recreate it exactly. So it's hard to think of experiments. You can think of experiments that would support the theory, but to actually really reproduce would be very hard. So.
Well,
what you can say is all the other species in Europe and Asia all disappeared. So we had something going for us. So.
Absolutely, yeah. Ajit, this was so much fun. I read your book years ago. I was so happy that when I reached out, you agreed to do it. I really appreciate you being so kind with your time and energy, despite some of the challenges that I had mentioned in the beginning. I really appreciate your willingness and your endurance here, and your just brilliance in how you're looking at these things. So it's a really big honor that you took your time to talk about it, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah.